It's Susan from Murph, and I'm here with Bjorn from In Flames, and I'm so happy to meet you.
Hi.
Welcome to Portland. I actually met you in 2000 when Dick Lofgren subbed in for Peter.
Oh, wow. That's a while ago, yeah.
Little club in the Satyricon that's closed down now. Mm-hmm. And then Peter's last show was here.
Yeah, maybe it was.
Their last show, and I mentioned briefly at Ground Control. I'm not shy if I have a purpose, but if I don't have a purpose, I'm super shy, so I couldn't even say hi. So.
Yeah, we'll go on there later.
You are touring on the newest album, Eye the Mask. With the exception of this album, which one's your favorite?
Wow. I mean, they're all very special, and they will always be, because they led us to where we are today, and being able to travel the world and hang out with cool people and play metal and drink beer. I mean, it's insane, really, if you think about it. And having a career that this long and still loving it, you know, all these albums have done that, you know. Like, the first record I ever recorded was Gestures, and it was obviously very important for me. It was the first time I ever made a record. I've done demos before, but it's always been super low-key and everything. And it kind of killed some of the magic that I thought was being poured onto these vinyls, and I understood that it's a lot of work behind it. But it was very important to understand everything there. So I'd say that one probably is the most important, but the latest one is obviously the most fun.
It's interesting. I love all In Flames albums, but up to Sounds of a Playground Fading is when I realized that it meant something to me more than just awesome music. Mm. It's like from that album through Siren Charms, through Battles, through the last one, Eye the Mask.
Eye the Mask, yeah.
The brain fade there for a second. I haven't had a chance to let the new album to feel it yet, but the other ones have followed my life, like the soundtrack to my life, and I'm sure that you must hear that a lot from people.
Well, every now and then, which is awesome, because, I mean, at the end of the day, we're making this music for ourselves. It might sound very egoistic, but it really is the only way for us to stay true to who we are and to what we like, and being able to enjoy what we're doing. But when you hear stuff like that, it's amazing that, you know, the stars align and everything just might happen for a reason.
Yeah, it was interesting. I know with Siren Charms, it kind of gave me the strength to leave, and Battles helped me, like, recover from that decision. So I'm really excited with Eye the Mask to see what it does. I know that you're recording differently the last two albums, you and Anders in the room together. Do you think that'll move forward in that direction?
I mean, we wrote that way. We didn't actually record the album that way. We still do it, you know, piece by piece. We actually did, the last thing we did was the drums, I think. So we're playing to program drums for a long time. But I think what changed is more the writing process than the actual studio routine. And of course, I mean, the last two albums has been recorded in LA with the top-notch people that, you know, it was an absolute pleasure. And normally I see making a record as something that you kind of have to do in order to be able to go on tour. But these last two records have been just a pleasure, working with Howard Benson and his team, like Mike Plotnikoff, Hatch and Nagaka, and all those guys. It's like, they have their shit down, you know? And for us, that was so good because, I mean, people in the past have had that too, but not this way, you know? And it saved so much time that we could just be in the studio for 5-6 hours, go back to the house, continue writing. Yeah, being just creative. So, yeah, I really, really enjoyed this last week.
As an American, it's pretty nice that you record here. All of your drummers post-Daniel have been Americans.
Americans, yeah. Nice one right there. That's Tanner.
Nice to meet you. When you write a song, is there a point when you know that song is done? You just feel it in your body, or are there other elements like 3 minutes, studio time's up?
Never studio time's up. That's not how we work. We've never worked that way. And it's because we always write an album, and it takes the time it takes. I know there's a difference nowadays of how some bands record, but we just like to take our time. I mean, we want to be efficient when in the studio. I don't like being in the studio just for being in the studio. I like it because you go there with nothing and come out with something that was not around, you know, a couple of weeks or months before. So that part I like, but we write an album, not singles or anything like that. So I'd say one of the hard things is to know when it's done. Because you can always go in there and you know, change and do things to the song. And I think that's part of the actual craft. I mean, it's one thing to be creative and come up with ideas, but there's another side to it, which is more the something that you learn over years, and it's like arranging a song or something like that. And knowing when to let go is one of those things that you have to learn.
I wondered if it was like a feeling, like you could just be like, okay, that one's done. Or an album, like at the end of the album, do you just know?
Well, we have an interesting way of doing it, and I love the way, because it gives us such a... What we do is, like, fairly early on when we have some demos of the songs, Anders starts putting together like a track list already very early, like 3-4 songs in. It's like, yeah. And then you can look at that like a blueprint to know what's missing and what we need to do more or less of. And then you have it in front of you, like visual. And that really helps in the songwriting, so we know what to approach the next, you know, for the next song. Or, yeah.
When he comes to you with that, he hasn't written lyrics or anything like that. It's just a general, like, skeleton?
Yeah, it could be a skeleton. Could be just a few riffs. Could be something that he wrote, just a couple of words that just means a lot, you know, and we work from there. But it's also, you know, it all fits together, you know, in the end. And again, we write albums, you know, and so we see it as a whole thing. Record labels need videos and stuff like that. We don't.
Throughout your catalog, I know that Anders has written about life experience, especially
later ones.
Later on. And I wonder, does he ever come to you with something and you're like, you're crazy, we're not doing that? Or vice versa? If you write something, does he ever say that that won't work?
I mean, after all these years, we know each other really well. And we also know where we want to go with this. I mean, there's no plan, but, you know, the basics, like the meat and potato of the songs, you know, we know about that. What's going to happen is there are always surprises, but they're always like happy surprises, you know, like, wow, this turned out even better, you know, than what we thought. So
you've been written up as one of the top 100 metal guitar players before.
Well, that's funny.
It's true. And your
who was fucking I doing that?
Your solos and your playing is really identifiable, and there's not a lot of guitar players who have
really
achieved that.
Oh, I struggle every night.
I know with your solos, I can feel emotion. I can feel if it's a sad song, or I can feel if it's an uplifting song, or love, or, you know, depression, or whatever. Do you feel like you could communicate every emotion on the guitar?
Oh, that's... I've never gotten that question before. I don't think so. But how I approach the solo is always... For me, it needs to be the highlight. I mean, the chorus is usually the highlight, but for me, it needs to be the highlight of the song. I'm a guitar player. I love guitar playing. I mean, it needs to be, for me, it needs to be the highlight. So it needs to be something that's connected to the song, too. It can't just be some random shredding, because I'm not a shredder first, but also because if it's out of context, but if it doesn't fit the song, I wouldn't do it. It has to be... I like these things, like you have first... The first half of the solo would be something that's more... improvised kind of thing, and then you fall back into something that's recognizable within the song, just to get that connection. You know, I normally don't really think about this, so this is the first time I'm talking about it. But there needs to be a connection. It needs to enhance the song, not a filler. Never a filler. If there's no space for it, it wouldn't be a solo.
Right.
You know, there's some songs that we have that has no solos, and to me, it's just important that it actually makes something good for the song.
That's one of the things that I particularly love about your playing is I'm a huge Michael Schenker fan.
Oh, and this is awesome, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a feeling. You know, you can actually feel when it's from your heart.
Yeah.
I did an interview with Burton Bell from Fear Factory just a month or so ago, and he said something that was so neat. And he said that when I write something from my heart and it touches you as a listener, then we're connected. And I feel that. I feel that with music. And
That's really how it works. I mean, going back to Anders' lyrics that we talked about a little bit, I mean, the way he writes stuff is like, if you can relate or put your own experiences into that, that connection you guys make will make the song last for way longer, you know, within you. And I really think that's the best way of doing it. Because it's not preaching, it's not telling you. It's like you connect and you create something of your own out of it. I think that's very cool.
Which of the albums that you've made is most personal to you?
That's a hard question. I'd say, I mean, again, going back to Jest Race, that was like, it was very important, and it really crushed a lot of my imagination about how things go down in a studio. I didn't even think about a studio, you know. I thought Ronnie James would just get poured milk from the angels and just make it into an LP and, you know, it would be awesome, as always, you know. But I didn't understand all that stuff. But so that was really important for me to understand the amount of work people put into this and how many things need to work together for this to actually become something, you know. That's why it's interesting that we now at this age and this far into our careers are still learning, you know, working with Howard. He taught us so much, you know, and I think that happened during the Jest Race too. So I don't know, emotionally invested, but understanding wise, you know, that was very important, and that's still happening this day, which is fucking cool.
It's nice to know that a guitar player like you can always learn.
Oh yeah, and now we got Chris hanging out with us and helping us out when Nick's home. That's a really good guitar player, and I'm actually playing more guitar than I have done in years because of him. Because he's always playing guitar.
I read a long time ago, this is off subject, but that you had a metal allergy and you actually glued contact lenses to your fingers. Is that true?
Yeah, Japan. It was awesome. It actually sucked. But
and now they fix strings, so you don't have to do that.
Yeah, Jimmy Dunlop is awesome. He just makes these coated strings that I can use, and it really helps.
So when you construct a song in your head, guitar part-wise, do you also hear the bass and the drums that you want with it?
Yeah, always.
Does it change by the time the song is done?
Or it could. I mean, it really could. It depends a little bit. I mean, I do this together with Anders and the rest of the boys who happen to be there. But most of the time, I have a very clear picture of how I want it to sound. And I always present to the other guys everything. So it would be all the harmonies with the guitars. It would be the drum, you know, the drums being programmed pretty much the way that I want them to sound. Not in super detail, because I like the drummers that we have, because we've had some really, really good drummers to put their mark on it, obviously. But if there's anything like following the rhythm guitar with the kicks or something like that, I'll be very specific about it. And also the bass is always there. So that's how I like to present even the roughest ideas that I have. Always. So I have a very clear picture of how I wanted to sound.
I'm jumping around, but I'm also a huge Rush fan, which is weird for a girl. But I understand that you didn't like Rush forever.
That's 2112, right?
Which album was it that you discovered that you liked Rush?
It is this one, actually. Well, I wouldn't say it was an album. It was on my 30-something birthday. We were in the U.S., and a really good friend of mine gave me a birthday present. And I was like, wow, this is cool, man. The show was done. We were sitting, hanging out. And he gives me this present, this gift, and it's the Rush R30 DVD. It's like, dude, you know I don't like Rush. You know, my uncle has tried forever, my whole upbringing, to get me to like Rush. I was always into, you know, Ronnie James. It's like, it's a man. Coverdale, you know, Bruce Dickinson, all that stuff. It's like, these are, I couldn't stand his voice for the longest time. And then he just gave me this, well, I gave you this as a gift. You got to listen to it. Okay, man, okay, let's open a beer. We'll crack the beer, put it on the tour bus. And 3 hours later, I was still sitting with the same beer. I haven't touched it, and I was blown away. This is really how you should experience. Maybe not on a DVD, but live. Mm-hmm. It's really like, wow. Really? I've been missing out on this my whole life. But I got really lucky to see them a couple of times. I saw them a couple of times in Sweden, and I'm glad I did, because they're not around anymore.
I have a theory that sometimes you like things immediately.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to like things through repetition.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're just not ready for it.
Yeah. Like, and I think I wasn't ready for it. It's like I was so into, I mean, my dad's a metalhead, right? So I got all this. I got the Rainbow, the Dio, the Purple, Sabbath, Whitesnake, Van Halen, even, you know, all this stuff I got from him. And when I started searching for, you know, getting my own identity, whatever, it turned into death metal or thrash and stuff like that. And there was no room for Rush in there, you know? And then when I was 30, whatever I was, and he showed me this, it's like, I've been missing out. Because the musicianship, the songwriting, yeah, the skill level is just insane. So
I have 5 fan questions for you.
Okay.
But we can also talk about anything else you want to, if there's whatever something I've missed. All
right.
Brett Makowski from 36 said to say hey.
Yeah, well, I'll say hey back.
I will.
Yeah, Sandra. 36, fucking awesome. I love those guys. Toured, I haven't seen those in ages, but
Kyle is the new drummer, and he's from Portland.
Actually,
a couple
here?
Of them live here now, and some still in Alaska.
In Alaska, yeah.
Sandra from South Africa said to say hello, and when are you coming back?
Oh, soon, I hope. We loved it down there. We spent almost was over a week in South Africa, I think. And it was, I think we did like 5 days in Joburg and then just 1 or 2 days in Cape Town. But I'd love to go back. It was amazing. People were awesome. The nature is just crazy. And it's so far away from where I live in Gothenburg. So it's awesome down there. So yeah, hopefully very, very soon. Yeah, I heard the Ramfest is coming back. I think it was gone for a while, and I heard Ramfest is coming.
Cole wants to know, how did you select Chris to come to fill in for Nicholas?
Well, we didn't really have much time. We had, I think it was not even 48 hours until I was going to be on the plane. The crew was already here, setting up for rehearsals and everything. So we were kind of, not panicking, but like, really, this is kind of bad timing. What should we do? We don't want to cancel. And then I think the first or second name that came up when we started talking about this was Chris Broderick. And it's like, is he available? He was available. Oh, we're good. You know, I knew. He's amazing. So we've known the guy from, I said, 17, 18 years ago or something. So we've toured together a lot. And I know he's just an amazing guy. He loves playing the guitar. And as soon as I heard his name, yeah, I knew. We're good.
You must have had some sleepless nights, though, going through stuff.
Well, yeah, let's put it like that. It's a lot of, you feel like you have this responsibility always, which is important to have, because it's, a lot of people pay a lot of their hard-earned money to go see a show, and that's a responsibility. You can't joke around with that, you know. So, and that, and also the crew, I mean, all of a sudden you tell them that, oh, by the way, the next month and a half you're not going to be working, you know. It gives them no chance to find something else. And it's just a lot of things that goes through your mind. But also I know that we've always pulled through, you know. It's always been an okay solution. It's happened before, but it's as frustrating as ever when it happens. But we pulled through.
There is a producer in town named Aaron, and he wanted to know what the method to achieving the guitar tone on Clayman was.
Oh, shit. That's almost 20 years ago, so thanks for that question. It was kind of, I wouldn't say a rough recording, but Frederick, the producer at the time, we did Jester Race, I mean, basically Lunar Strain, Subterranean, Jester Race, Oracle, Colony, and then Clayman was the last one he did. He was hanging out way more during the first couple of records, and then on Clayman, I think he became a father for the first time. So he was only working 9 to 5. So whoever made a guitar solo fucking between 9 to 5, nobody, right? So that was kind of a rough one. So we didn't really see him that much, and I don't remember. I think we probably used 5150s. He had a great 4x12. I remember that. So vintage 30s in there. And I just remember that sounded amazing, that 4x12. It's a Mesa Boogie one, I think. That worked really good with the 5150. And we probably mixed it up with some other guitars as well. Guitar sounds as well. I don't remember. It's been a very long time.
Well, I wanted to say that you have made my life better because of your music. It is, again, the soundtrack to my life, so thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, let's talk about beer. No, I'm kidding.
We have lots of good beer here.
You do? Mm-hmm. You do. And for the longest time when we came here to this venue, we always took a right. And there used to be a, when we got out of the venue, we took a right for some reason. Mm-hmm. We always did. And it was always like scrap backyard or like industrial site, and there was this one Chinese restaurant called Hung Far Low. Mm-hmm. And that's where we ended up every year. And then a couple of years back, somebody said, well, let's take a left, and we ended up in the most awesome city ever. So it took us forever to find that out, but this is really cool. Actually, love being here.
I think I've mostly seen you at this venue, but you know, the little Satyricon, mm-hmm, place you played holds like what, 40 people? Portland is an interesting and fun town, but with good beer.
It is. Very much. Well, still, this is a functional beer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.